Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Well, welcome indeed to Book Expo 2008. My name is Chris Keneally. I'm delighted to host a special panel discussion here. I am the moderator of a program called Beyond the Book, which is underwritten by the nonprofit Copyright Clearance Center and which can be found at beyondthebook.com. And joining me will be a number of panelists to take a look at a rather slightly ambitious subject, and that is the future of reading. And it strikes me that it's not only the future of reading, but the future of readers, the future readers themselves, who they are, the future of publishing, and finally, the future of books. And I call to mind something I remember reading about the Lumiere brothers, who were the inventors of really the first practical film cameras at the end of the 19th century. And one of them said that the cinema was an invention without a future. And clearly missed that a little bit, considering here we are in Los Angeles with Hollywood just down the street. But I can imagine that if Gutenberg were to invent movable type again today, he would probably have the same kind of lament, given the competition that the book world has with so much other media. He might think that he would say to himself, the book was an invention without a future. And yet, what kind of a future is it? Well, we can judge a little bit by the past. There's been some numbers released recently that show that 277,000 new book titles were published in 2007, which represents something like a 1% increase over the previous year, and still sounds like a lot of books to me. And interestingly, the number of print-on-demand, short-run, and non-traditional book publishing, that is growing enormously. So individual authors really have great faith in the book themselves. Those numbers have increased from 21,000 in 2006 to 135,000 such titles in 2007. So it's dramatic, and I think we're going to expect to see that continue. But for the discussion, I want to turn first to Paul Dry. Welcome, Paul.
Welcome, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Very delighted to have you. And Paul is, if I can name him, a kind of evangelical figure, for me at least, in publishing. He started Paul Dry Books after many years trading stock options on the Philadelphia Stock Exchange, and at least as many years, if not more, reading books. His first books appeared in the year 2000, and the Paul Dry Book motto is books to awaken, delight, and educate. The list includes adult and young adult fiction, memoir, philosophy, poetry, and history, and offers new writing, works in translation, and republication of out-of-print titles. But he has an author on his list who first published a book several years ago in 2004, I believe, Gabriel Zaid. And his book will, if you will, be the kind of touchstone for our conversation today. It was called So Many Books, Reading and Publishing in an Age of Abundance. And he has a new book out, which I can also recommend, The Secret of Fame, The Literary Encounter in an Age of Distraction. And Paul, those two phrases, age of abundance and age of distraction, seem to mean a lot to Gabriel. And tell me what they mean to you.
Well, I think we're all faced with the phenomena of too muchness. Certainly at the BEA, almost everyone walking down the aisle either feels overwhelmed or has learned how to screen out a good bit of what they've walked by. So in abundance, what did you say, 290-some thousand titles?
277,000
titles. And that abundance creates distractions. In addition to all those titles, of course, the endless time we spend on the internet, either with email or visiting websites, what does that mean about reading a book from beginning to end? Well, we're distracted from that activity. And I think that's what Gabriel was getting at, all of the ways we can be distracted from finishing, from reading a complete book. It's very easy on the web to skate around, and it's very easy to hop from one book to another without ever giving yourself the chance to finish a book. Now, obviously, people here are readers, but we've all experienced the overload and the enticement to hop from one web page to another, from one author to another.
And the distraction affects all aspects of publishing. We tried to get Gabriel to come and join us today, and he had a tremendous reply, I think an email to you. What did he say?
Well, Chris asked me to print it out, and there it is down at the booth. Essentially, he said he wanted readers, he didn't want viewers. And in fact, we don't have permission to print his photograph on the book. He really is serious about wanting people to read his book and not wanting to become an object of a spectacle. Much of the book, The Secret of Fame, is about the possible emptiness of literary fame and as a diversion away from the experience the reader has of the book itself.
And that impacts the reader, it seems to me, because we're all susceptible to the attraction of fame, and so we're drawn to the famous writer, if you will, and kind of bounce around as the media directs us from one famous or newly coined famous person to another, and it gets to that point you mentioned of the need to read something completely.
Yeah, I know it's passé to say that a book should have a beginning, middle, and end. And the French film director Godard said, fine, but not necessarily in that order. I do think things that books with beginnings, middles, and ends in that order, as the author decided what the order was, are really, that's the treasure. That's what we carry around in our imagination. And some of these books we take in so rapidly it's pure joy, and others take a lot of work. When I first read Tolstoy, I was about 25, and I thought life had passed me by. And I started reading Tolstoy, and I looked around. It was absolutely empty, the room. And I was looking for the person I could blame for not telling me to read War and Peace sooner. If they'd only told me it was so easy and so much fun, I would have thought, what the hell, I'll read it at 16. War and Peace is a long read, but those of us who have skated into it, it's just an endless pleasure, like one box of popcorn after another.
Well, since you're competing, your books and all books are competing with this abundance of media, what do you think the future of books then will be, and the future of your books? Have you got a degree of optimism, or are you resigned to a niche?
Well, no one can say what the future of the books he or she publishes will be. That seems to be up to the fates. Certainly, the future of reading is as assured as the future of eating. We'll continue to eat and we'll continue to read. Of course, what we eat and what we read will be up to us and what we find nourishing. So I would argue that the future of reading and of books in particular and of my books will depend on whether readers find them nourishing and pass that on.
So if you were just to continue the metaphor of eating, there's food, of course. There's fast food and slow food and good food and bad food. Does it matter with reading, about good reading and bad reading and so forth?
Well, we've all probably been to McDonald's, and we know it's fun. And we've all read books that are like McDonald's, and they're fun. I mean, no one's going to cross the so-called junk books off the list, or the good books, or the very good books. But when you've come across the good book, the great book, it's the calories are better to stay in the metaphor. That doesn't mean they're easy to read. And I'm in a book group, and very often we'll end up reading a book that I never would have read. And the harness of the book group pulls me along, and I read the book. And I think as as you harness yourself to a book that otherwise you wouldn't have, you have an opportunity to have a great reading experience. Now, book clubs are thriving in America, even as we lament the fate of reading. So I'm not discouraged at all about reading. As a small publisher, I find it very hard to get attention for my books, but welcome to the world. I suppose the big publishers find it hard to get attention for their books, too. It's all on scale.
And the competition that books have today with other media is one where it brings them up against the work of the imagination against the work of the image, if you will, and the notion of reading that we all enjoyed as a small child, perhaps under the blanket at night with the flashlight, the imagination took control. Is there anything lost as imagination kind of diminishes and images grow in power?
Well, surely I think so, but I would just tout the activity of imagining that a book allows the reader to experience, and that it's your image of Dorothea Brooke in Middlemarch. It's your image of Long John Silver, or your child's image, and the child has made that image, and you as an adult have made it. And we all know the sense of letdown, really, when you see the movie. Oh, that's not how I imagined that figure. Well, we're not going to do away with movies, but we shouldn't let them co-opt our imagining activity. We should know that it's a little harder to make up Natasha in your mind than to see a beautiful young actress enact Natasha, but it's your Natasha, and it never goes away. And curiously, your Natasha and your friend's Natasha is something you hold in common as an act that you created individually, but that you have in common. The Natasha on the movie screen is neither of yours. It's the one that the movie made. So that's my plea for reading in terms of a possession you have and never is taken away.
Well, I think the audience can better understand now why I say you have this evangelical theory of publishing. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you, Chris.
What I'd like to do next, though, is turn to someone who really has a different perspective, one very much tied to books, but very much also looking ahead to the future. And that's Anna Maria Alessi, who was named publisher of Harper Media in March 2005. She first joined HarperCollins Publishers in 2001, and now oversees publication of all adult and children's audio titles and all HarperCollins e-books. For HarperCollins Audio, she's published many classic children's books, including Laura Ingalls Wilder and C.S. Lewis, and many frontlist authors, including Lemony Snicket and Jamie Lee Curtis. There was a recent announcement, which you may have read about, where Harper is now has its own internet TV studio in its offices in New York, and that was what caught my eye. And so I guess my first question, Anna Maria, first, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you here. My first question is, what's going on at Harper? I thought you guys were book publishers.
Well, we are author publishers. The way that I try to communicate what we're collectively trying to do is that, in my opinion, we're trying to talk about authors as much as we talk about books. And that is a subtle but sort of important distinction. And all of our efforts are moving towards putting an author in front of a consumer so that, to use Paul's reference, you know, why didn't somebody tell me about, this great book when I was 16 instead of 25? What we're trying to do is make sure that those books and those authors are out there and in front of potential consumers, because there is a lot of distractions, potential distractions, and a lot of our job is to make sure that a consumer knows that there's a new publication and that they would be interested in reading it for some very good reasons.
How do your authors respond to that? The sort of classic picture of the author is alone in a room with, his typewriter or number two pencil, and here you're really encouraging them to come out of their studio and into the real world.
Well, authors want to be read, And that's where we start the conversation. We want to go find as many readers as possible for you, and here is a menu of all of our different efforts, and it involves people all across different departments, and we see that obviously as the end goal is to have more readership or listenership, and they appreciate it very much, and they're a tremendously enthusiastic and happy to partner with us. We are approaching them in a much more collaborative way now, and saying this is what our expertise is, this is how we think we can contribute to your efforts, and here's a roadmap that we've put together, and you know, what can you do? And basically they say we'll do pretty much whatever you want us to do, because it will lead to more readers.
Now, your internet TV studio has only been open for a short time, so it's hard to draw any really substantive conclusions, but what kind of activities have been going on, and has it been just book promotion or more than that?
It currently has only been book promotion. It's been up for about 30 days, and we've had nearly 35 authors in. We are using it to spread the word of what they're doing, whether it's a current publication or a future publication, or, you know, in the case of Simon Winchester, to come in and sort of comment on current events. We talk about how it's modeled after a newsroom environment, and that is because we hope to be able to pull people in and get the video posted very quickly to take advantage of anything that might be happening in the news or any, you know, publicity opportunities. And it's gone very well. We have a tremendously talented producer, but she hasn't had to work too hard, because when you ask an author to talk about their work, it's usually pretty darn fascinating. They have great stories to tell about how they came to this project and what the result of their effort was.
And Paul talks a great deal about the conversation that books and authors have with readers. And here it seems to me you're encouraging that kind of conversation. And the way that people correspond or interact with authors today is increasingly through the internet. So if you were to record that, presumably you could have something up this afternoon about a response to the earthquake in China, if you had someone who was an expert in
like
that.
Simon Winchester.
Absolutely.
His new book is about China. So absolutely.
And where does that put Harper in the picture? Increasingly, the media, which was the gateway to news, publicity, is receding, because you can go directly to the web. Is that something you're sort of banking on? You can get directly to the individual?
Yes. I mean, a lot of what we do at Harper is to try to bring efforts in-house and sort of do things ourselves. And this is another example of that for a variety of reasons. We think that that makes a strong approach. And yes, absolutely. So now we can create the product, and we can be effective in placing it in a variety of ways. We give it back to the marketing and direct marketing and publicity departments, and they tailor its placement for each individual author and book.
Well, it strikes me that that's also ensuring the future of publishing in a way. If we're talking about the future of reading here, the publisher has to continue to have a valuable role in this, because otherwise it could just be author direct to reader. I'm not saying that that's bad necessarily, but if publishers want to stay in business, they need to find ways to add value to the equation.
Yes, and we do think that, you know, we can add a bit of expertise, whether it's shooting the video or recording the audiobook or, you know, placing an interview. You know, we talk about how we don't ask authors to design their book covers. So, you know, we want to be full service in terms of, marketing and publicity and a wide variety of business models and formats. You know, our job is to promote any idea that the author has. You know, so these are a variety of ways that we're doing it.
And your own background, your own professional background, is interesting, because you came to Harper not from the world of what you told me was bound books, and I found that an interesting phrase, sort of books unbound, but also books unbundled, or the unbundling of the content, if you will.
Right. I'm not a traditional publishing person. I started at Harper 6 years ago in the audio department as an editor, and I've never had a book job. I love authors. I love books, obviously, but I also I really do believe that that there are a variety of ways that an author can get his or her idea to the world, and I'm very excited to be part of that effort to get the idea to the world in any format that is successful in reaching people.
Well, here at Book Expo, there's been a great deal of attention to the ebook and the Kindle and so forth. And, you know, the response, it was interesting to me, the most interesting response was somebody, a man who often has his eye on the future, Steve Jobs, was asked about whether he was going to try to compete with the Kindle. And he basically, you know, denied the book a future. He said, why would I bother? No one reads anymore. And how do you respond to that?
I respond somewhat cynically by saying I don't really believe what Steve Jobs says publicly, and I think that it, in fact, encouraged me that it's more likely that he's working on a delivery system for book interiors than ever before, and I have a little, you know, so I'm very skeptical.
Well, you know, I think the future of books is tied up in the past, and I just have to share a short story. I met recently a publisher of Latin and Greek textbooks. And so I asked him, what's new in dead languages these days? And what he told me was that they were doing a podcast series of Cicero and Caesar and so forth. And the
fantastic.
Yeah, and the podcast series is called I, Podius, which I thought was terrific.
You gotta love that. That's fantastic. I mean, it's anything that we can do to put the words and the ideas in front of potential consumers, I think is a good effort, and I think that I'm encouraged as well. I think people are going to read. I think they're going to read in different ways, and I do think that, you know, reading bound books is likely to diminish, and probably reading long formats is likely to diminish. But I don't think it's going to diminish hugely, and I'm not discouraged that ideas are going to suffer. In fact, I think ideas will probably gain in currency as we have more opportunity to run into them.
Well, we're going to start thinking this is all just a group hug, but I'm glad to hear it, because we certainly know that the future of the newspaper seems to be very much in doubt, and printed forms of all kinds really are under threat. But there is a sense that the book is an object that will survive all of this. Thank you very much, Anna Maria.
Thank you.
I'd like to turn now to Deborah Kovacs. Welcome, Deborah. Deborah is Senior Vice President of Publishing at Walden Media, a film studio specializing in the adaptation of children's classics. You may already have seen some of their movies. I rather think you have. They include The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, Holes, Because of Winn-Dixie, and The Bridge to Terabithia. Debbie has overseen their publishing activities since joining Walden in 2001 and was instrumental in the formation in 2005 of a publishing joint venture with Penguin. They've adapted more than 20 original works, and that includes the newly published book Savvy by Ingrid Law. And most recently, Debbie was central to the establishment of Walden Pond Press, a new imprint to be housed at HarperCollins. Welcome again, Debbie. And tell me about Walden's view of the book. Clearly, we know it as a film company, but you see it in a different way.
Yeah, the movie is a ruse to get children to read. This is a literacy company. We happen to make movies.
Well, so your sense of content then goes beyond the film itself.
Absolutely. Over the last 7 years since the company was founded, I think we've given away probably 500,000 books based on our movies, because, yes, it promotes the movie, but in our opinion, if the kids don't read the book, we're all missing the point. And all of us at the company are avid readers, believe in story, believe in the importance to kids, incredible importance to kids, of having the story experience, and what Paul is describing as the opportunity to form the images in their own mind. I mean, admittedly, we do add those images, but honest and true, it is done as an afterword past, we really, really prefer having the kids having read the books first, because it's just, we think it's fun to show them what we did with what they might have imagined, but we would love them to come into it with their own pictures first.
Well, the reason I wanted you to join us today was because if reading has a future, it has to have future readers. And so what you're involved with, your goal here is to create those future readers and to kind of build an appetite, it seems to me. Does the book itself matter, though? The book is object. How do children today respond to the book as object?
I have an anecdotal example based on this book, Savvy, that Chris just mentioned, which I hope all of you have a chance to read it. It's an absolutely fantastic book. But the thing that one of the things I like about it the best, I won't go into it too much here, but it's a coming of age story about a girl who's 12 who's about to turn 13. And when Penguin designed the book, they decided to make it a certain kind of compact shape. It's not a normal shape. It's kind of wider and shorter. There it is. Thank you. Yeah. It's wider and shorter. And the first time I sat with a group of kids who had read it and talked to them about it, it was the most one. I'll never forget it, because they were all at a very awkward stage physically, and they all had the book tucked under their arm. It fit exactly under their arm. So the book was a story, but it was an object. It was a transference object of a sort that was clearly, they just wanted it right there. They wanted it, you know, next to their heart, I guess you could say, because something about the experience that writer had granted them had become part of them. And to me, that's what it's all about, you know, wherever you find your stories. And I happen to start and finish with books myself, but I think it's fine if a film opens minds up too and brings the kids back to the book. That's fine.
And perhaps you should tell people a bit more about what Walden is trying to do to reach the influencers in these children's lives, and tell us too how the influencers, and thinking parents, teachers, and you can tell us who else,
and librarians
and booksellers, how do they respond? You know, there's such a flood of news that, to Paul's earlier point, points to other media. Do people wonder, do they ever say to you, well, gee, I don't think, you know, kids want books?
I never hear that. I mean, certainly we talk the most to teachers and librarians and parents, and I've never talked to one who said that, ever. I think they are grateful for anything that can draw the kids back to reading. I think all of us recognize the responsibility that we have to the development of kids' minds by ensuring that they're readers, because I think that they need that focus and that concentration. They need to use those. They need to do the mental gymnastics that you do when you're reading and when you're following a story in your imagination. It's just extremely important to their development and to their growth and to their future as humans.
Well, you're also a children's book author, we should say, and working in film, I wonder whether that medium has had an impact on your own writing, or perhaps in reverse, are you and others at Walden who may be more, planted in the word rather than the image, having an influence on how Walden films turn out?
We are a very collaborative group. We communicate a lot. We do. I sort of think that those of us that are on the book side of the company kind of take on the martinet-like role of, we really are strong defenders when we've chosen to adapt a book. We try very hard. It doesn't always work. It's a very large and complicated process with many, 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 many players. But we try extremely hard to be advocates for the original message of the author, which doesn't mean a literal interpretation, but it does mean respect for and reverence for the original intent, because why adapt somebody's work if you don't revere it, you know? So we often work very collaboratively to find ways to make sure that the arc and of the meaning that was in the original story makes it all the way through, if possible. It does not always happen, but that's definitely one of the kind of gifts we have in our environment, because we do have that kind of discussion at the stages where the scripts are being developed.
Well, Hemingway said something interesting about his relationship with Hollywood and mm-hmm. the films that were made from his books. He said he thought of it as basically he would drive up to the border of California, throw his manuscript over. If anyone threw money back, then he just drove away with the money.
He was a smart man.
Indeed. So, but Walden is, it seems, seems to me intentionally bifurcated. You've got the publishing side on the East Coast, not far from Boston, and obviously making movies here in Hollywood.
But we are also, in some instances, acquiring books, which we are then developing into films. And so the relationship, and I think that's probably unusual in that our relationship on some projects now and moving into the future starts at the manuscript stage, and it starts with a relationship of trust and understanding with the author from the beginning. And, you know, hopefully that, we're still at the early stages of that, but hopefully that will be a hallmark for us moving forward to just really... You know, if we've chosen a story to bring forward in print and then in film, you know, we hope to find the best ways to sustain the message of it throughout the process.
Well, we'll be watching and reading, I suppose, right? Well, thank you very much, Debbie Kovacs. I want to turn finally to our last guest, Irene McDermott. Comes to us from the world of libraries and will tell us a bit about whether libraries are museums or not, museums for books. She gains insights about the web and the world of publishing from what she tells me is her daily frontline experience as a reference librarian at the Kroll Public Library in San Marino, California, not so far away from here. She writes about these discoveries in a column, Internet Express, which has appeared monthly in Searcher magazine, and recently published the second edition of her book, The Librarian's Internet Survival Guide, from Information Today. She speaks often to meetings of fellow librarians and indeed has addressed the Library of Congress as part of their Luminary Lecture Series. Welcome, Irene McDermott.
Thanks, Chris. I'm delighted to be here.
It's good to have you here, and I thought it was important to enjoy the conversation with you because libraries are often where, at least as children, we first discover this world of books, and perhaps because libraries are almost warehouses of a sort of books, that can be an overwhelming experience, rather like BEA. But in a world where we've got all these media distractions, are libraries at all in danger of becoming museums of books, or I would hope not, but mortuaries of books?
Well, in fact, the exact opposite has occurred, Chris. Since the advent of the Internet about 13 years ago, across the nation, circulation and use of libraries has gone up at least 50 to 60%. It's fantastic. People come in, they use our books, they use our Internet. We have wonderful book clubs, as has been mentioned. The Oprah books bring in people, and that's just the adults. We're co-conspirators, is what we are, with publishers, to help children really develop their brains to be able to read the technology that is books.
And you said something to me as we prepared for our conversation that struck me as interesting. I know the library is the place where I've done research for my books, and it's the first image that comes to mind to me, the sort of repository of knowledge. But librarians have for a long time seen their role as kind of connecting people to entertainment as well.
Absolutely. Since about the turn of the last century, public libraries have taken on the dual role of having information for practical use in the world and also being an outlet for entertainment, such as fiction books that people read.
But it's beyond the form factor, which it's not simply the book itself.
A book can be considered a technology, a codex technology, which has its roots really about 2,000 years ago when we turned from scrolls to actually having a book where you could turn the pages. So that is one form of technology that we offer our books in. Another is large print books, and a very popular format is books on tape or CD or MP3 player. Lots of commuting, lots of listening. We consider that reading.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. If people are coming to the library to use their computers and so forth, they're reading, but they're not reading books. They don't end up taking out books, or you say they do?
They actually do. Once they're in there, they're right next to them, so why not? They do take them, too. The more you take out, the freer they get.
And what about the role that librarians have? Librarians don't take courses in marketing themselves, I can't imagine. They take courses in the Dewey Decimal System, and so they learn how to organize the works, but they may not actually be taught or be thinking about how to promote the work. true or not?
Yes, that is a failing of librarians, and we've realized that. We're literally, among ourselves, taking marketing classes, how to push more information out. We're trying to develop podcasts ourselves. So we have authors come to speak, and we push those out onto the web as part of the content that we give our potential patrons.
And what about the library as this quiet place? That has changed, probably has to change. How have you, as a librarian yourself, accepted that change?
Well, we accepted that change with a change in architecture. We just had our library just opened in January, and it features what modern public libraries have, acknowledging its dual role with two constituencies that just don't get along. One constituency is our traditional constituency of older readers who like it to be quiet. Another is the after-school kids crowd. And these kids are really studying, but they get together in a group and they talk to each other. We've actually developed a system. The library is divided in two, and over in one corner is our study area where the kids go after school, and the other is the adult area. We make sure they separate out when they come in, and then it's not a problem anymore.
What about cell phones? Wireless PCs, that's great because people can bring in their own computer. They don't have to just access yours and do the research. But cell phones and texting and all the other things that, at least to cranks like myself, seems annoying, does that have a place in the library?
Well, we have started just now allowing some cell phone use in the library, but we do ask if people are talking loudly that they go outside. Texting is silent. We wish you'd text. Text.
And that's writing itself, so it's reading, so
right,
maybe it's going to help
reading.
Them read, I suppose. So, are librarians moving forward with this, too? You go to Old Navy, and you see them walking around on the floor with the wireless microphones telling each other what's what. If somebody's looking for a book, do you kind of get that assistance in the new library?
Well, we're really hoping to move towards that. Lots of libraries are. So they're constantly connected that they can answer, we can answer telephone questions and questions from the circulation desk and all these at the same time. So, yes, that's a movement.
But finally, how do you respond to this age of abundance when it comes to books? 277,000 titles published last year. You can't possibly acquire all of them. And then there's the additional works of non-traditional publishing. The role of the librarian as another form of gatekeeper, how difficult is it, and especially when people divide themselves now into so many separate constituencies, you really have to have a book there for everyone, don't you?
Absolutely. Of course, not all libraries are the same, and there's not really a perception of that outside, but there's academic libraries, just like there's different stores. There's car part stores, and then there's Walmart. You don't go to Old Navy to get a car part. In that way, all libraries are different from each other. Our library happens to be a shallow new collection because we have a restricted area to store books. So a lot of times, some of our older books that don't circulate, we allow those to go out to our bookstore. So you just have to decide what kind of library you are. Are you a new library, or are you an archival library?
And any words of wisdom, if you will, from the library's reference desk for publishers as far as your relationship with them?
Well, we are your biggest advocates. We shop. We love to shop and buy things from you. So anything you can do to help guide us is just wonderful.
So things like access to internet author or internet interviews with authors and so forth would certainly be helpful to you as well.
Yes, and we also like authors to come to our library and speak. Those events are very, very popular.
Well, thank you all. Thank you, Paul Dry, Anne Maria Alessi, Deborah Kovacs, and Irene McDermott for joining us today.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.